So this is the second of two lectures on optimum portfolio selection. Where we left off on Monday, we were looking at building portfolios made up out of two risky assets, and only two risky assets, which I labelled A and B. We had already learned from Monday's lecture that the correlation coefficient between the returns on asset A and the returns on asset B was a key variable. At the end of the day, what we're trying to do by building portfolios of assets is reduce risk. Reduce risk by means of diversification, by spreading our wealth across a number of assets. Here we have only two, just to keep the maths as simple as we can make it. The idea of spreading our wealth across a number of different assets, that's called diversification. That's a strategy for reducing risk. And we want to reduce risk because we are risk averse. We looked at two polar extremes. We looked at the case where the correlation coefficient was +1, so-called perfect positive correlation, and we looked at the other extreme where the correlation coefficient was -1, so-called perfect negative correlation. The case in which the correlation coefficient is +1 is really boring. It's of no interest to us at all from a finance perspective because there's no scope for diversification. If we want to reduce risk by constructing a portfolio made up out of two risky assets that are perfectly positively correlated with one another, we have to be prepared for a like-for-like drop in expected return. No interest. Whereas the other extreme case is very interesting, because what we saw in that case was not only was there scope for reducing risk, but we could, in fact, find one particular combination of the two assets which were perfectly negatively correlated that resulted in a portfolio with zero risk. And that portfolio I might call a perfect hedge portfolio. Now that only works in the extreme case where the correlation coefficient is exactly -1. That begs the question of what happens in general then, because in general the correlation coefficient is a number somewhere between -1 and +1. Typically, if we're building portfolios of equities, these are the shares of listed companies, either on one, listed on one stock exchange, so all UK equities, or possibly all US equities, but even if we're trying to form international equity portfolios, where we're drawing on the shares of listed companies that trade on different exchanges, typically we find that the correlation coefficients are positive. They're not +1. By any means, though. So the question is, what happens usually? What happens in the general case? So let me remind you of two expressions that I hope by now you are familiar with. You should be able to write down without thinking an expression for the expected return on a portfolio of two risky assets. You should be able to write that down without thinking. You also need to be able to prove it. And one of the seminar questions for next week gives you the opportunity to demonstrate exactly that. Likewise, you should be able to write down an expression for the variance of returns on that portfolio of two risky assets. And you should be able to go interchangeably between an expression that involves a correlation coefficient and the two standard deviations, and equally well, an expression that involves the covariance between the returns on the two assets. Which one of the two you use depends on the information that I give you in whatever question I ask you to solve. So you should be able to write that down without thinking. We looked at the two extreme examples. When the correlation coefficient is +1, combinations of these two assets sit somewhere on this straight line. When the correlation coefficient is -1, combinations of those two risky assets sit somewhere on this straight line segment or somewhere on this straight line segment. You should be asking yourself the following question immediately. You should be asking yourself, is that it? Is that the full range of possibilities for those two values of the correlation coefficient? In other words, does this straight line, in the case where the correlation coefficient is +1, does this straight line extend further in either direction, or is it bounded by the two points A and B? Likewise, do these two straight line segments, which meet at one point on the vertical axis, corresponding to the pure hedge portfolio, can I produce either or both of those two line segments? And what you should next be telling yourself is, well, surely that has to do with the weights of the portfolio, the weights of the two assets in the portfolio. If the weights of the two assets in the portfolio are not allowed to be negative, then the diagram tells the full story. But if the weight of one or other of the assets is allowed to be negative, now if one of the weights is negative, the other weight must be bigger than one in order that the two weights continue to sum to one. If we're allowed to have a negative weight, either for asset A or asset B or both, then these straight line segments can be produced further in these directions. Having a negative weight is often referred to as short selling. So if you come across the phrase short selling, in this context, if you're short selling an asset, you have a negative weight in your portfolio. So really what I have to say to you is, this diagram describes the full set of possibilities for those two extreme values of the correlation coefficient if short selling is not allowed. In other words, the individual weights must be non-negative. But if you're allowed to go short in one or other of the assets, A and B, then you can in fact situate yourself outside of this diagram. So those are the two extreme cases. Now we're interested in what happens when the correlation coefficient takes a value somewhere between minus 1 and plus 1. Then the set of portfolios that you construct sit not on a straight line, but on a curve. What makes the problem interesting is that the curve bends to the left. Bending to the left is bending in the direction of reduced standard deviation of returns and therefore reduced risk. So we're interested in the possibility of combining the two risky assets A and B to form portfolios that have less risk than we would be exposed to if we put all of our money into A alone or B alone. That's what makes the problem interesting. That's the first learning point. The second learning point is, how does the value of the correlation coefficient impact this curve? And the answer is, as we reduce the correlation coefficient further, so think of us starting with a pair of risky assets which are perfectly positively correlated, so our graph is this straight line. Now look at a different pair of assets where the correlation coefficient is less than plus 1, maybe 0.5, say. This might be the curve that we will generate from the set of possible portfolios now. If we reduce the correlation coefficient further, maybe 0, say, then the set of portfolios will sit on a curve that bends further to the left. The further the curve bends to the left, the greater the scope there is for diversifying away more of the risk. If we carry on the story, say now the correlation coefficient is in the negatives, perhaps minus 0.5, then the graph goes further to the left. In the limit, as we push the correlation coefficient towards minus 1, this curve is going to get closer and closer to these two line straight line segments. And when we get to minus 1, the curve snaps into place. At least that's the idea. Let's see if it's true. Here's a spreadsheet that I've built. So what's going on in this spreadsheet? What's going on is we have two risky assets, asset A and asset B. Again, in my graph, my axes are the same as usual. Standard deviation of returns on the portfolio along the horizontal, expected rate of return on the portfolio up the vertical. So these are the two individual risky assets. And summarized at the top of the spreadsheet, just so we know what we're doing, are the properties of these two assets. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read from where you're seated, but a copy of this spreadsheet will be uploaded onto my.wbs after next week's seminars. So in these two cells are the values of expected return for each of the two assets. So it's 10% for A, 20% for B. In these two cells are the values of the standard deviations of return. So it's 50% for asset A, 70% for asset B. And in this cell is the correlation coefficient, and at the moment, that value is 0.5. So we're looking at forming portfolios of these two assets for which the correlation coefficient is positive, but it's not plus 1, it's 0.5. And the spreadsheet calculates a range of possible combinations. That's what's going on here. Different combinations of weights. So this column is the weight of asset A, this column is the weight of asset B. The two numbers always add up to one. So what we're doing in this part of the spreadsheet is we're basically walking ourselves round the curve in this direction. We are tilting the composition of the portfolio away from asset A and towards asset B. The spreadsheet doesn't know anything about short selling being allowed or not, so the curve is produced, extends beyond the points that represent A and B, because as far as the spreadsheet knows, one of the weights is allowed to be negative. So I haven't imposed that restriction. If I'd imposed the restriction that the two weights be non-negative, then the curve would have been bounded by these two points. Why have I created the spreadsheet? Because I'd like to see what the effect on the curve is of changing the correlation coefficient. So if I just put it back to 1 for a minute, good. What I hoped would happen has happened. If the correlation coefficient is plus 1, then the graph is a straight line that joins the two points representing A and B. If I now reduce the correlation coefficient to 0.5, that should take me back to what was there a moment ago, and it does. And now as I reduce the correlation coefficient further, this graph had better bend further and further to the left, and that's exactly what's happening. Let's make sure it carries on. Now the correlation coefficient is minus 0.5, and let's test my final hypothesis. If I push it to the limit, correlation coefficient is minus 1, I'm expecting to get two straight line segments, or as close to that as the graph will indicate, and that's what happens. So the spreadsheet enables you to test out, for different values of the correlation coefficient, how the set of possible portfolios looks in terms of the diagram, and it's consistent with my little cartoon. And that's what you need to remember and understand. Now, so far there are only two risky assets. We're only going to have two risky assets today. Let's not run before we can walk. And when there are only two risky assets, the portfolios that you can form from those two risky assets sit on one of these curves. It's not possible to sit inside the curve when there are only two risky assets. When we generalise it to 3 and 4 and 5 and blah 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 risky assets, then it's also possible to construct portfolios that sit inside this bounding curve. But for the moment, we're limiting ourselves to two risky assets, so please be clear, the only portfolios we can form for a given pair of assets all sit on one of these curves. What decides the curvature of the curve is the correlation coefficient. That's what matters. And the learning point for us here as finance people is, really, if we want to reduce risk, sure, form portfolios of the two risky assets, but go in search of risky assets that have a low correlation coefficient between one another. We'll be more successful at reducing risk if we spend some time selecting those two assets. Ideally, we would like to have two assets that were perfectly negatively correlated. That might be a fool's errand. It might not be possible to find them. So we have to make do with selecting assets for our portfolio that are not very strongly correlated with one another. Because the lower the correlation coefficient, the greater the scope for diversification of risk. That's the learning point. Now, if you look back a few slides, indeed, it's enough just to look on this slide. Here's the expression for the expected return on the portfolio of two assets. Here's the expression for the variance of returns on the two on portfolios of the two assets. We know the two weights must always add up to one. So you could rewrite that expression for the variance of returns on a portfolio in terms of one of the weights, let's say the weight of A. You just substitute for WB, you substitute WB equals 1 minus WA, so you get an expression in terms of WA only, and now you can solve for that particular weight of asset A that minimises the variance of returns. That's a problem in calculus, and again I've set it for you as one of the problems in next week's seminar. You need to be able to do that, because that sort of exercise is good fodder for an exam. That's the sort of thing I need you to be able to do. You should be able to convince yourself that for a given value of the correlation coefficient, so we've settled on the two particular risky assets A and B, the particular combination that minimises the variance of returns, and therefore the standard deviation of returns, is this combination. So you should be able to persuade yourself that that's the value of the weight of A, and 1 minus that is the value for the weight of B that produces the portfolio with the minimum variance of returns. In other words, that point on the graph, or that point, or that point, whichever is the value of the correlation coefficient. So I can call that the minimum variance portfolio for a given value of correlation coefficient. You need to be able to determine its composition. In other words, you need to be able to solve for its weights. And once you've got those weights, you can then work out the expected return. So you can work out the height of that point on each of these curves, and you can work out how far to the right does that point lie. You can work out its variance and therefore its standard deviation. You need to be able to do that. You also need to be able to do it in the limiting case. You should get the same answer in the limiting case when the correlation coefficient is minus 1. We've already looked at that problem. In that limiting case where the correlation coefficient is minus 1, the minimum variance portfolio sits there. So this general formula, in the case where the correlation coefficient is minus 1, it had better collapse to a formula that we've seen already. And you need to convince yourself of that. It had better reduce to this formula for the composition of the perfect hedge portfolio when the correlation coefficient is minus 1. And again, you need to be able to do that for yourself. So the seminar questions next week are going to give you lots of opportunities to practice doing these things. And you should be clear in your mind, I could ask you to do any of this as part of an exam question. So far then in the story, there are 2 risky assets. Depending on the correlation coefficient between the returns on the 2 assets, we obtain a curve something like this that represents the set of possible portfolios formed from A and B. What do you notice? What you notice is there's a limit to how far to the left you can go. That might be a problem for you. If you're highly risk averse, you might be concerned at that. I'm afraid that's the best you can do if your choices are limited to these 2 risky assets. However, you have more choice if there's another investment opportunity, namely the risk-free asset. Now, the risk-free asset we've met already in passing, the risk-free asset by definition has no risk, so it sits on the vertical axis. The height of that point is the risk-free rate. So if you want to think of it, that's your bank account. More correctly, that's an investment in a money market security like a treasury bill. That's as safe an investment as you can have. So from this point onwards, you can divide up your money between the risk-free asset, asset A, and asset B. Equivalently, you can divide up your money between the risk-free asset and some combination of risky asset A and risky asset B. So some portfolio. Let's say portfolio P. Now, the minute we have the opportunity to invest in the risk-free asset, now what does that actually mean? That means we can lend or borrow money at the risk-free rate. If we have the opportunity to do that, we have more choice in terms of the portfolios we can construct, because now we can think about taking combinations of the risk-free asset with, say, this portfolio P. And any point on that straight line segment would represent what I would call a lending portfolio. We are lending some of our money, say, to a bank. When you deposit money with a bank, you expect to earn some interest. That interest is your additional reward for lending the bank some money. So any point on this straight line segment is made up out of some investment in the risk-free asset with the balance of your money, your wealth, invested in the risky portfolio P. But the weights of both the risk-free asset and portfolio P are positive. If I sit bang in the middle between these 2 points, I'm investing 50% of my wealth in the risk-free asset, in other words, I'm lending 50% of my wealth to a bank, and I'm investing the remaining 50% of my wealth in portfolio P. If instead I decide to go 25% loaned to the bank, 75% invested in P, then I'm 3/4 of the way up the line. I think you get the general idea. But in each case, it's a positive weight invested in the risk-free and a positive weight invested in portfolio P. In other words, positive proportions of my wealth. Can I push this straight line any further? And the answer is yes, if I'm allowed to borrow. And in drawing the diagram I've drawn, I'm assuming we can borrow at the same riskless rate as we can lend. In reality, that's not true. So this is a simplification. So how do I get myself up here? The reason I've drawn it as a dashed line is I might not be allowed to borrow. If I am allowed to borrow at the same rate as I'm allowed to lend, then I can position myself here. How do I do that? Answer, I invest all of my own wealth in portfolio P. It's all gone. But in addition, I borrow some more capital and I invest that in portfolio P as well. We would refer to this, possibly, as a geared-up portfolio. I've invested 100% of my own wealth in portfolio P, but I've borrowed some additional funds and I'm investing that as well in portfolio P. And the more I borrow, the higher up this part of the line segment I will sit. When we're borrowing money at the risk-free rate, we have a negative weight invested in the risk-free asset. Because the weights must always sum to 1, the weight invested in portfolio P must be bigger than 1, bigger than 100%. And that's why it's often referred to as a geared-up investment. So if riskless lending and riskless borrowing are possible at the same rate, then I can put together portfolios made up out of the riskless asset and this particular portfolio P. I can position myself anywhere on this straight line. That straight line is given a name. It's called the capital allocation line. But who said I would want portfolio P? It doesn't have to be that portfolio. Presumably I can choose any portfolio on this curve because the curve represents the set of possible combinations of risky asset A and risky asset B. So that sets me thinking, which portfolio might I want to choose? So you've got to look at the diagram and ask yourself, well, what is it I'm trying to achieve? And then you need to remind yourself of what you're like. And what you're like is greedy and scared. Or if you prefer, rational and risk-averse. A rational, risk-averse investor would like to be as high up in the diagram as possible, but as far to the left as possible. It's not possible to do both simultaneously. There's a trade-off. How can we model the trade-off? Answer, look at the slope of the line. We'd like to make the slope of that line as big as possible. So what you should now be asking yourself is, okay, how does the slope of the line that joins the point representing the risk-free asset to a point on this curve, in other words, a particular combination of asset A and B, how does the slope of that line change as we move around the curve? So you can think, if you wish, you can think about starting at point A, walking round the curve, as we were doing earlier, but now we're interested in how the slope of this line is changing. The slope of the line is given a name. It's called the expected Sharpe ratio. It's called expected because it's defined in terms of expected return. If we had actually observed the return, so we had real data, then we would just call it the Sharpe ratio. But let's be careful. It's the expected Sharpe ratio. It's how high up divided by how far along to the right. Convince yourself that that's exactly what that definition is doing. It's measuring the gradient or slope of the straight line that joins the risk-free asset to a particular point on the curve. More importantly and more usefully for us, because we would like to maximise the return we expect on the portfolio over and above the risk-free rate. In other words, how much higher up are we than the risk-free rate? How high up are we in this diagram? We'd like to maximise that. We'd also like to minimise how much risk we're exposed to. Well, we can optimise that trade-off by going in search of the maximum value for this slope. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to go in search of the portfolio, the combination of asset A and asset B that maximises the expected Sharpe ratio. If you know how to do that, you potentially could make a lot of money in the real world. That's a very useful skill to have. That's a very useful skill to have if you have ideas about being a fund manager in the real world. Because this is your technological way of optimizing the trade-off between wanting to maximize expected return and minimize risk. You might find clients are interested in doing business with you. So the graph is telling us how we should go about it, and the sharp ratio is our way of modeling the problem. So, what are we going to do? We're not going to make do with portfolio P. We're going to go in search of that particular combination of asset A and asset B that maximizes the slope. And as I hope you can see, that is achieved when the point on the curve we're joining to the risk-free asset is the point of tangency. Now, you really do have to go through this in your mind at least once. You really got to mentally walk yourself round the curve, starting, say, from point A all the way around to point B, and convince yourself that the following is true. Convince yourself that as you start on your journey around this curve, the slope of the line that joins the risk-free asset to that particular point where you are on the curve, the slope of the line is increasing. As you bend round now, the slope of the line continues to increase. But once you have gone beyond the point of tangency, the slope of the line once again starts to fall. So there is a maximum. There is one point on the curve. There is one combination of risky asset A and risky asset B that does the job for us. And that's what we're after. We want to be able to find that portfolio. Find that portfolio means we want to be able to determine its composition. We want to be able to work out the weights of asset A and asset B in portfolio T. What do you notice about portfolio T? Well, it might be stating the obvious, but it's a very handy check on our calculations. Portfolio T sits on the curve. That means it's made up only of risky asset A and risky asset B. There's no risk-free asset in the so-called tangency portfolio. So if, in the course of solving any such problem that I set you, you set about working out portfolio weights, and you decide that your portfolio T has some investment in the risk-free asset, you've gone wrong, because there is no investment in the risk-free asset. The line, the straight line that joins the point that represents the risk-free asset to the point of tangency, that straight line represents the possible combinations of the risk-free asset with the tangency portfolio. When we sit at this point on the vertical axis, all of our money is invested in the risk-free asset. In other words, we've loaned 100% of our wealth to the bank. As we start to walk up the straight line, we're lending less than 100% of our wealth to a bank. The balance, we're investing in portfolio T. The higher up we are up the straight line, the greater the percentage of our wealth that's invested in portfolio T, the less, the smaller the proportion that we're prepared to lend at the risk-free rate. When we sit exactly at point T, we're lending nothing. 100% of our wealth is invested in portfolio T. If we're allowed to borrow at the risk-free rate, we can push the story further. We can start to position ourselves higher up the straight line. Where we sit on the straight line depends on us. It depends on what level of expected return do we wish? What level of risk are we prepared to tolerate? Now, that's an individual decision. What we're going to see shortly is that everyone agrees on the location of portfolio T. So everyone draws the same straight line. The only thing that distinguishes one investor from another is where on that straight line do they sit? And that goes to the heart of their individual risk preferences. The more risk-averse is the investor, the lower down this line they will sit. The less risk-averse they are, the higher up the line they will sit. If they're comfortable with a relatively high rate of risk, Not only will they invest all of their own money in risky portfolio tea, but they'll borrow additional funds and invest that as well in portfolio tea. So again, you should be saying to yourself, this is the limiting case of what we talked about before in the context of portfolio P. This is the best set of situations. On the solid straight line segment, I'm looking at lending portfolios. Some of my money is being loaned to a bank. The balance is being invested in T. On the dashed straight line segment, I'm looking at borrowing portfolios. All of my own money is being invested in T, and in addition, I am borrowing some more money and investing that as well. Why? Because I want to sit higher up the line. Why do I want to do that? Because my target expected rate of return is higher up than T. I want to be up here in the diagram. What the diagram is telling you is, well, if you're allowed to borrow at the risk-free rate, you can do that, but you have to be prepared to live with a higher level of risk. The higher up this straight line you are, the further to the right you are. That's the message to emerge from this diagram. So this summarizes the tangency portfolio. Remember, it's made up only of risky asset A and risky asset B. The question is, how do you find it? So now we have to state clearly, clear understanding between us, what the rules of engagement are. So you should write this down and hold me to it. And if I violate it, you're welcome to sue me. You don't need to know where the equation on this slide comes from. You don't need to know where it comes from. I'll never ask you to prove, I'll never ask you to derive from first principles this matrix equation that sits in the middle of the slide. We're going to take that on trust. However, you are expected to be able to write it down for yourself without proof. And the reason for using the matrix formalism, in my opinion, is it will help you to remember the equation, and therefore a better chance that you'll write it down correctly. Because if you write it down wrongly, we might as well kiss goodbye to most of the marks for the rest of the question, if it's in the exam. So your job, what you need to be able to do, is write down this equation, this matrix equation, correctly. And now I'm going to try and give you some intuition to help you remember it. But I'll never ask you to derive it. That's the deal. So I remind you of what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is maximise, optimise if you like, the trade-off between wanting to have as much expected return as possible, but for as little risk as possible. And the way we are modelling that is to maximise the expected Sharpe ratio. So let's be clear here. You better be able to write down an expression for the expected Sharpe ratio. So I could present you with a scenario in which there are two risky assets, A and B, and a risk-free asset, and I could ask you to start off by write down an expression for the expected Sharpe ratio. So you would start with the definition, then I'd expect you to be able to manipulate that expression a little bit. I would hope you could convince yourself that working from this definition of the expected Sharpe ratio, or SR for short, you can rewrite that expression in terms of the weights of asset A and asset B in the portfolio as follows. Just take a look at the numerator for a moment and convince yourself it's correct. Convince yourself that if you start with the numerator in the definition of the Sharpe ratio, you can rewrite it in terms of the weights of A and B as shown. In other words, what I'm asking you to check is that I'm making use of the fact that the two weights sum to one. That's the little trick there. Because clearly this part, WA times the expected return on A plus WB times the expected return on B, that's fine. That's just the expected return on the portfolio, as we saw before. Where do the other two terms come from? Answer, they both involve the risk-free rate being multiplied by the sum of WA plus WB. That's just one. Now, why am I rewriting it this way? Because I want you to think in terms of excess expected return. The expected return on a particular asset, or indeed the portfolio, over and above the risk-free rate. So this particular combination, E of R minus RF, is useful to us. Remember the constraint that the weights of the two risky assets must sum to one when we're looking at the tangency portfolio. because the tangency portfolio sits on the curve. So the problem then is, find the values of these two weights, WA and WB, that must always sum to one that maximizes this ratio. And the answer is, the way you get hold of that is you solve this matrix equation. Now, why is another matter. I can't assume a level of mathematics on everyone's part. It wouldn't be fair, given that you do different degrees. I can't assume that you could all work out where this comes from. If you can, that's good. It won't be of any particular help to you in the exam, but it's always good to be able to do that. Look on the left-hand side and see what we have. On the left-hand side, we have the weights of the risky assets. There are only two so far in the tangency portfolio, written as a column vector and been multiplied on the left by an old friend of ours that I hope you recognise as the variance-covariance matrix. I'll remind you how that matrix is assembled. In the leading diagonal positions are the variances of the two risky assets. In the off-diagonal positions are the covariances. I've just chosen to write them here in terms of correlation coefficient. Now, you owe it to yourself to be able to write that down without thinking, because I've now told you that the left-hand side of this matrix equation involves multiplying the variance-covariance matrix by the weights, expressed as a column, the weights that you wish to solve for. And that's always the case. So if you like, what's going on the left-hand side is addressing the risk part of the story. On the right-hand side, almost but not quite, on the right-hand side are the individual excess expected returns. One for asset A, one for asset B, again expressed as a column vector. And the only slight complication is there's a multiplier outside. What's that doing there? That's there to ensure that the two weights you obtain as your answer still add up to one. So the job of that multiplier is to enforce that constraint. So now you should be able to write down that matrix equation without thinking. You just have to remember that on the left-hand side are the variables, the parameters that describe the risk inherent in the story. So that's the variance-covariance matrix. And on the right-hand side, we're really tackling the return side of the story, but it's expressed in terms of excess expected return. And to make sure that we get a meaningful answer, there's a scaling parameter that enforces that constraint. But I hope you're now thinking something else as well. I hope you're also thinking to yourself, okay, I may or may not know where this comes from, depending on how much I know about constrained optimization problems. Fine. I can't assume that you know anything about that. If you do, fair and good. But what I hope you're thinking to yourself is, this must generalize. He started off the lecture talking about an artificially simple situation in which there were only two risky assets, A and B. But that's not the real world, because in the real world, fund managers assemble portfolios involving more, sometimes many more than two risky assets. But this matrix equation generalizes in the obvious way. You do what I've encouraged you to do in the past. You grab hold of this matrix and you stretch it. Just you pull that downwards and to the right. And as you pull on that matrix, so additional rows and columns appear. It's always going to be the same. For each new asset you introduce into the problem, there's an additional variance. So if there were three assets, A, B, and C, there would be a third row and a third column, and in the diagonal position would be the variance of returns on asset C. In the off-diagonal positions would be the covariances between the returns on asset A with asset C, asset B with asset C. On the right-hand side, you pick up an extra row. Excess expected return on asset C. In other words, expected rate of return on C minus the risk-free rate. The matrix formalism is screaming at us how the problem generalizes. So we've cut our teeth, we've done a fair bit of thinking on Monday and again in this lecture about the situation where we have two risky assets, but already we can look ahead to see how the problem would generalize to three, four, etc., etc. I'd love to set you a problem in the exam that had three risky assets, but I can't. And the reason I can't is I'm not allowed to assume you know how to invert a 3x3 matrix. So there's something else you might want to write down as a deal between us. If I ask you a question on this sort of stuff, that's limited to two risky assets and a risk-free asset. That doesn't mean I can't ask you to talk a little bit in words about how the situation might generalise to a greater number of risky assets, but in terms of the number crunching, the worst I can confront you with has a 2x2 matrix. And of course, during the maths and stats review, we looked at matrices, and in particular 2x2 matrices, and the formula for the inverse of the 2x2 matrix. You haven't got a hope in wherever of solving this equation for the weights unless you can invert this 2x2 matrix. So you want to make sure that you can do that. Once you've got the weights of the two risky assets in the tangency portfolio, now you can determine the expected return on the tangency portfolio, the variance of returns on the tangency portfolio, and therefore the standard deviation. In other words, you don't just know now how to build the tangency portfolio, you know exactly where it sits in the diagram. Problem solved. That's it. You've simplified the problem. Everyone will agree on the composition and the risk-return properties, i.e. the expected return and the variance of returns of the tangency portfolio. The only thing that people will differ on is what combination of the risk-free asset to take with the tangency portfolio. So, let's just pull that together. Investors who are relatively risk-averse will build lending portfolios. Lending portfolios are made up out of combinations of the risk-free asset and the tangency portfolio. A positive proportion, a positive weight, is invested in each. So lending portfolios sit somewhere along this straight line segment. The less risk-averse the investor, the further up the straight line they sit. Investors that can tolerate a higher level of risk and who wish to have a higher level of expected return, they will construct borrowing portfolios. So they will sit on this part of the straight line. That's assuming they can borrow in the first place. What you might like to ask yourself are the following questions. What happens if they can't borrow? What happens if investors can't borrow at the risk-free rate? What happens if the rate at which investors can borrow is higher than the lending rate? Because that's the real world. How does the diagram change if the borrowing rate, I'll call it the riskless borrowing rate, is greater than the riskless lending rate? You want to think back to the lecture on investment under certainty. You want to think back about how the straight line changed when the riskless borrowing rate was greater than the riskless lending rate. And then you want to ask yourself, what impact, if any, does that have on the location of the tangency portfolio? Is it still the case that there is a unique tangency portfolio that you take in combination with the risk-free asset? So for the purposes of this lecture, we're assuming that riskless lending and riskless borrowing are both possible at the same rate, and that's what gives us a single straight line, and therefore a single or unique point of tangency. And because of that, that enables me to assert that what investors do is divide up their money between the risk-free asset and the tangency portfolio. In other words, all investors are doing the same sort of thing. They're building as their own investment portfolio some combination of the risk-free asset and the tangency portfolio T. So all investors are using the same two ingredients. This result is known as two-fund separation. Two-fund separation. All investment portfolios can be built up, can be constructed from the same two ingredients. The risk-free asset, that by definition introduces no risk into the portfolio, together with the tangency portfolio. But for this statement to be true, the tangency portfolio must be unique. And for the tangency portfolio to be unique, we have to be able to lend and borrow at the same riskless rate. If that's not true, two-fun separation breaks down. And what I'm asking you to think about, you don't have to do any complicated calculations, you just have to try and imagine, how does the diagram change when the riskless borrowing rate is greater than the riskless lending rate? Hint. The slope of this line is less. The slope of this line is reduced. But remember, the straight line must touch the curve. If we're reducing the slope of this line segment, it's not going to touch the curve at this point. It's going to touch the curve somewhere further to the right, because the new point of tangency is over to the right. So if the assumption that riskless lending and riskless borrowing are possible at the same rate breaks down, one of the consequences is that we end up with 2 points of tangency. Two-fund separation no longer holds. In this case, we might position ourselves on this part of the line segment. We might position ourselves on this new line segment that may meet the curve, say, over here, at a second point of tangency. Or we might situate ourselves somewhere on the curve between the 2 points. Maybe you can see why I'm insisting on riskless lending and riskless borrowing being possible at the same rate, because otherwise the problem starts to get more complicated. We're not going to pursue that, but I would expect you now, after 3.5 weeks of finance, I'd expect you not just to be taking everything I tell you on trust, but to be asking yourself, what assumptions is he making in arriving at these results, and what might happen if we relax one or more of those assumptions? Now, it would be wholly unfair of me to set you a numerical problem that would require more advanced mathematics to solve these general problems. But there's nothing to stop me asking you, as part of an exam question, to discuss how the solution to the problem might change if, say, riskless lending and riskless borrowing were no longer possible at the same rate. That's the spirit of this module.